The hour of 10:30 having passed due to poor planning of the session this morning, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. And since we don't have a vice chair, Representative Knorr has graciously volunteered to fill in because he was actually at all of these hearings and he can move the minutes. So Representative Knorr, on the agenda, we have three motions for you. So would you please take up your first motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I bring out the motion, the first motion is for the minutes. I move to the approval minutes for March 28, 2023. I think that was adopted, so I'm going to... Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's March 30, 2023, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Representative Knorr, we know we're breaking you in, so we'll have a little leniency here. So Representative Knorr moves the minutes of March 30th, 2023. Is there any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion approved. Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I move the approval minutes of the minutes from Monday, October 6, 2023.
Representative Knorr moves the minutes from Monday, October 6, 2023. Is there any discussion to the motion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, move the approval of the minutes from Monday, November 6th, 2023.
Representative Knorr moves the minutes from Monday, November 6th, 2023. Is there any discussion to the motion? Representative Cleaborn.
No, after this motion, please.
All right. Seeing no discussion to this motion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Representative Cleaborn.
Mr. Chair, I hate to ask this question, but on the second motion that we just adopted on the approval of the minutes for October 6th, the minutes actually say October 30th.
Okay. Representative Cleaborn, you caught a typo, and we will correct the typo in the minutes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for catching that typo. I'm sure if I'd had the vice chair here at the appropriate time, we wouldn't have missed that.
Mr. Chair, I would like to call you out for setting up Representative Knorr in an erroneous fashion. So.
Representative Cleaborn, Representative Knorr has done such an outstanding job representing his portion of the University of Minnesota, which he practically lives in. I feel comfortable calling him out on any higher ed issue.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleaborn.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate to use personal relationships to move legislation forward. Just saying.
Representative Cleaborn, I considered the relationship with Representative Knorr very professional.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, the next thing we have on the agenda is the Office of Higher Education. And I think Commissioner Olson is coming down, and he may have, well, he has a series of people who may assist him. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record. Members, there is information in your packet. And members, if we don't get through all of this today, at our next meeting, we will continue with the Office of Higher Ed. So there's no rush to get through necessarily today. So Commissioner Olson.
Well, good morning, Chair Pawlowski and members. For the record, my name is Dennis Olson. I'm proud to serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to start this new session by talking about our work here over the last few months since the conclusion of the last session. I'm going to start by previewing something my staff will talk about later, but you know, I think it really sets up our presentation perfectly. Yesterday we had a projections meeting for the state grant, and you know, that incorporates a lot of enrollment projection data. And our initial projections show that fall 2023 will mark the end of a 14-year decline in college enrollment statewide here in Minnesota. And this is something certainly to celebrate, you know, and while we don't yet have the program data to show a direct line from all of the historic investments in higher education that were made last session to this increase in enrollment here that we're seeing, you know, I believe that those investments that we have made will continue to make an impact long term as well. So, you know, from the investments in current programs to new banner programs like the American Indian Scholars Program, the work we did last session, it certainly changed the conversation around higher education here in the state of Minnesota. As you well know, our direct admissions program has garnered much national attention, both from the media as well as from other states interested. And direct admissions seeks to help every student see themselves as college material by proactively admitting them to a Minnesota college or university. So you'll hear a few testimonials throughout the presentation, but the response from students, you know, are really that they're excited about the program. It's truly overwhelming to see the student response so far on this new program. And, you know, we have a wait list now of high schools looking to participate and join next year. Of course, the North Star Promise program, which officially launches this coming fall semester, covers the cost of tuition and fees for students earning less than $80,000 a year. And by removing this financial barrier, more students who are low income or from historically excluded populations will be able to enroll in a Minnesota college and, of course, pursue their dreams. North Star Promise has also made an impact on the market, both within the state and the region as well. Both Concordia in Moorhead and Gustavus have made news to that they've launched their own scholarship program with similar eligibility requirements to North Star Promise as well. North Dakota State, some of you may have heard, NDSU, also launched a one-year program that was modeled directly after the North Star Promise program. We've heard news recently that South Dakota, state of South Dakota, has launched their new South Dakota Advantage tuition program, offering reduced tuition or in-state tuition to their students and students from surrounding states. And then, of course, recently the UW system, the University of Wisconsin system, along with their legislature, they're currently contemplating a direct admissions program as well for the UW system. So these programs are changing the conversation about college affordability. They're putting students first. And, you know, while I, of course, hope students choose a Minnesota college, you know, fueled by the programs that we're investing in and have invested in recently, I'm excited to see that so many students benefit and, you know, that they honestly have options available to them. And, you know, we believe it'll continue positively impacting recent enrollment trends here. So we're excited to go through that with you today. And, you know, many of our investments, of course, such as dual training grants, have raised the visibility for great careers that don't require a bachelor's degree. And, you know, we're lifting up all the credentials, diplomas, two-year programs. We're continually working on shifting the conversation away from the perception of the ivory tower to really one of inclusion and possibility and opportunity for all students here in Minnesota. And, you know, just a few more points before we dive into it here. I mean, these programs that I'm addressing, only a few here, are only successful if we can successfully get the word out, frankly. You know, my communications team has been really intentional about reaching out beyond our typical networks and getting the word out about our programs. And, you know, it's been successful early on here. It's showing that it's working. You know, I recently had a close friend, a longtime friend from childhood, actually, who's a firefighter and an EMT in southern Minnesota in Litchfield. And he reached out to me recently and said, hey, this is the first time I've ever seen the Office of Higher Education come across my social media feed. What's going on here? And then, of course, he let me know that it was an advertisement and a recruitment outreach communication for the new paramedic scholarship. He was really excited by it, and first time seeing Office of Higher Ed, and, you know, had agreed to share the post far and wide within his networks. And, you know, that tells me that things are working, and folks are, you know, even reaching out to me to let me know some of the materials they're seeing for the first time. So definitely exciting. And then, you know, if I can get back to North Star for a moment, we'll go through it a little bit. You have some materials in front of you that were just recently put in your member folders. But, you know, we made a toolkit for promoting the North Star Promise program for direct admissions. Everything's available for download on our website. We've seen our handouts and social graphics being utilized all throughout the state by schools and communities. You know, and it's critically important that we establish a clear and consistent message for all to utilize to make sure our students, you know, are hearing that message and hearing it often. So we're excited about that. It's been working well. You know, we've truly put every single dollar that was invested last session to work. And we're excited to see the response, honestly. You'll hear from it through or about it throughout the presentation today. So one final investment that I'll mention, because you won't see it in the presentation, is the recent posting of our tribal relations director, our agency tribal liaison. That position is live now, and we greatly appreciate the support of the legislature for giving us the opportunity to, you know, not only meet the state statute that agencies have a tribal liaison, but that, you know, we have the ability to fund it here through support of the legislature. So thanks. That position closes here soon, and we're looking forward to a whole host of amazing applicants. I could go on, really, but I won't, Chair. I know I've probably been too long already, but you know, we're looking forward here, sharing the specifics and, of course, answering your questions and engaging with you. So I'm going to get into the presentation. I'm going to quickly just set the groundwork with some attainment data and then turn it over to our assistant commissioner who's joining me at the table here, Dr. Wendy Robinson, to get into some of the program specifics. So just a brief reminder, Mr. Chair and members, thanks to the foresight of the legislature in 2015 for establishing a statewide higher education attainment goal. As a reminder, Minnesota has one of the loftiest higher education attainment goals in the nation, setting a 70% goal by 2025 for Minnesotans aged 25 to 44 to attain some sort of post-secondary credential beyond high school. We also have, again, thanks to the foresight of the legislature, interim benchmarks of 30 and 50% for each racial and ethnic group within Minnesota as well. You can see we're estimated right now to be at 63%, and we'll be updating that data shortly here as we work with American Community Survey data through the census and through data from the State Demographer's Office, as well as data from our institutions. And so moving closely towards that 70% goal, but we do know that 2025 is right around the corner. We also wanted to mention here that thanks to support from nationally from the Lumina Foundation, but as well as great work from our folks here within the agency, we're now going to have the ability to include industry recognized credentials within the statewide attainment goal. This is an exciting piece because, you know, Minnesota is one of the first states to actually include certificate level data within the attainment goal. And now we're able to go even further to capture a more full package and picture of, you know, of the attainment rate within the state. And so that data is coming here shortly, and we're excited to share with the committee once it's fully completed. Of course, a graph showing you kind of where we are, you know, not only across the state, but, you know, Minnesota's picture, which I've shared with members before and with the committee before, is that, you know, although we have one of the highest attainment rates in the nation overall, we are one of the states with some of the largest leading attainment gaps as well when it comes to race and ethnicity. You can see, according to all race and ethnic populations here represented on the chart, we have made some incremental increase, but still a lot of work to do. And so, again, much appreciation for the recent investments. You know, I point you specifically to the American Indian data there, which I know we've talked extensively about, but, you know, making sure we meet that 30% and 50% benchmark. But, you know, we're certainly not going to celebrate unless this goal is met statewide, but also met equitably. And then finally, just the actual breakdown of the numbers to reach that 2025 goal. It seems, yes, sir.
Representative Rarick has a question. Oh. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure you were taking questions along the way, so thank you.
Well, I would hope we would sort of stage this where we could do questions in groups at certain times, but we'll allow it. Representative Rarick, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I was a little bit late. I was in the Rules Committee before I came over, so I apologize.
That was another committee that was ill-timed, but that's all right.
No argument with me, Mr. Chair. So back to the data, since we had such a difficulty with our higher ed institutions and even the pipeline to them because of the pandemic and because of and everything shutting down and it being kind of chaotic in Minnesota, and I realize these are estimates from 23, but I'm assuming you've got the data across the board. Are you able to kind of just give us a small picture of what was the impact on attainment when we were going through all of the crisis of the pandemic?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick, that is a great question. I mean, we've certainly seen impacts, you know, throughout all the data sets, you know, whether it be attainment data, whether you're looking at, you know, K-12 data and looking at graduation and other test data, certainly a major disruption there. That has impacted attainment data. We have yet to see kind of the full impact. It may take a couple of cycles of data to actually see, you know, where those dips and lows are. And these are estimates because, you know, this is a combination of data, like I had mentioned, from the census, from our state demographer, and, of course, from the data we receive from institutions on completion and graduation. But, yeah, we do anticipate a disruption, not anything that we're going to be able to see and represent completely yet.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was reviewing this before committee and thinking about this part of it in particular, you talked about, you know, the massive disparity between our top performing or achieving Asian, white versus, and even biracial is not doing so badly, but American Indian, Hispanic, Black are really, really struggling. And I'm wondering, I know that this is just a goal and we don't typically change that, but considering 3 years of really tremendous struggle for the nation and the world, maybe, Mr. Chair, would be something that we would entertain of maybe pushing off this the goal of 70% just a little bit in the future, just as an understanding of what this country has been through and particularly how difficult it was on these populations that are struggling. And I know we've done so much, but it puts us all collectively in a very difficult place when we know we really want to be there, but we've had some insurmountable difficulties to try to get there. So I just want to bring that point, and maybe it's something that we could consider just delaying it by 4 years.
Representative Rarick, we're going to have a thorough overview of everything we did last session. We started with two hearings in the interim, and we're going to continue. Both systems are well aware that at the campus level, I want to know exactly what we invested and how it is being spent. And we've already started with the Office of Higher Ed. I want to also compliment the Office of Higher Ed. We had an EMS task force hearing in Winona 2 weeks ago, Saturday. It lasted 2.5 hours long. There were about 70 people that attended it. Your office was praised greatly for how you have handled the implementation of what this committee passed. So I can't thank you enough. And members, I didn't repeat it, but I will now. This committee will continue with its motto. We're going to grab them by the budgets, and we're not going to let go. Commissioner Olson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I appreciate the compliments there for the hard work of our team. You know, you're absolutely right. We have been working, you know, really around the clock to make sure that, you know, all of our investments and opportunities are communicated and, you know, that Minnesotans are made aware of what's available to them. Mr. Chair, if I may just quickly respond to Representative Rarick's
Commissioner
comment. Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Rarick, you know, thank you for the highlight around the attainment goal. You know, I think I've made it very clear through past, you know, testimony, but really all of our strategic vision within the Office of Higher Education is built on the backbone of the attainment goal. You know, it really is. And it is aspirational, and aspirational for a reason. But, you know, I wholeheartedly agree with you for the reasons you stated, as, you know, as well as many others. I mean, 2025 is right around the corner. We're working internally, and, you know, we'll soon be working with some of our partners and stakeholders to take a look at the attainment goal and see if, you know, it's something that, you know, we should look to either reauthorize, extend, change parameters around. So I'm looking forward to that conversation and, you know, certainly welcome it along with the legislature as well. So thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. And this is completely just a gratitude and a thank you. So I have a child in college and I have one that's in high school and exploring. And so I have lots of friends who have children in that category. And the FAFSA form has changed, and people have a lot of questions. And your office, everybody I've talked to, has just said that they have received nothing but exceptional service from the Office of Higher Ed. And I know we put a lot on your plate. And so the fact that people continue to tell me that they have just gotten exceptional service every time they've had a question, every time they've needed information, with everything we put on your plate, I think is really speaks to your office and your leadership. And so I just wanted to publicly share that, because I've heard I was a little bit nervous with all the new FAFSA changes and everything that was happening, and I've heard nothing but glowing reviews, both from parents but also from our partners that are helping kiddos navigate the system. So this is my public thank you for that, and thank you. And to your whole team. It's exceptional customer service to the people of Minnesota.
Ms. Chair, Representative Hicks, again, thank you. And, you know, not only for me to hear that, but to have my team here in the room hearing that as well. Really appreciate that. So thank you so much.
And Commissioner, also from the chair, who illuminated your office twice in his 38 years here, I think you finally got it right.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Hopefully that's not still a thought swimming around in your mind. Ms. Chair, members, if it's okay, we'll step on the gas a little bit here. I'd like to get into it, so appreciate it. I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Robinson here, who's going to walk through a little bit of the enrollment picture I kind of highlighted, and then we'll get into it.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wendy Robinson, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants. I'm excited to have some time to give you some context about the enrollment picture both in Minnesota and nationally, and then talk about some of the efforts that we're doing to continue to support increasing enrollment across our state. As we've already noted, the pandemic was a really big challenge in higher education, both nationally and in Minnesota for enrollment, and that includes both enrollment of new students going into higher education and retention of students who are already there. When we're starting to look at the early fall 2023 data, we're seeing some really encouraging signs. Nationally, undergraduate enrollment is up just over 1%, but I think more importantly is that it's over 2.5% for our community college and technical college sector, and that was an area of higher education that was hit especially hard during the pandemic. When we look at our Minnesota-specific numbers, when we're seeing our early data, you know, we like to be above average, so we're pacing ahead of the national average with a 2% increase in undergraduate enrollment, a slight dip of under 0.4% for graduate student enrollment. We have some early indicators that suggest our community college and technical college enrollment also looks strong. So this is, it's early for fall 2023 data, so we're going to continue to look at that and then report that as it comes through. But as the commissioner mentioned, if these early estimates hold, we'll have seen a positive trend for the first time in 14 years, which is really exciting. It's something that, you know, motivates us and not doesn't encourage us to rest on our laurels, because we know that we still need to make up significant ground that was lost during the pandemic. One of the ways that we are continuing to support the enrollment pipeline in Minnesota and to support the college aspirations of our Minnesota students is through our direct admissions program. I know folks are familiar with the program because we've talked about it before, but just to give a highlight, this is a program that starts with the understanding that all of our students who graduate from Minnesota high schools are able to learn, should dream big about what their future is, and have a place in our college system, whether that's community college, technical college, four-year public, or four-year private. Our direct admissions program, we're currently in our second year of serving students, and we are considered a national model. We've probably had, I think, at this point, 15 other states reach out to us to find out how we do it. And one of the reasons I think we've gotten so much national attention is because we've taken such an inclusive approach by having all of the sectors of higher education represented within our program. This work really represents some strong partnerships between the K-12 system, Office of Higher Education, and our college and university partners. It also represents for students an opportunity for us to start shifting the narrative. We know that students and parents typically overestimate how hard it is to get into college and underestimate how hard it is to complete college. The truth is that most colleges admit most of their students most of the time, and so this gives us an opportunity to start telling students that message that they should explore their options in the state of Minnesota, knowing that they can have confidence to apply without an application fee and that they'll get a yes at the end of that process. Students will be getting, students get a letter in the fall of their senior year that gives them a personalized letter of colleges and universities that are committed to admitting them. In our second year of the program, we currently have 117 schools, high schools participating. Of those 117, we anticipate about 106 of them will likely finish the whole program. We had a few schools that had some staffing turnover and some challenges to be able to complete that. Our ultimate goal continues to be to scale this up so that every public high school in Minnesota is participating in the program. We're also creating spaces for private and parochial schools that might want to opt in as well and thinking about what that will look like. So as we look to the future for this program, our current plan is to scale to over 200 schools next year. So it's in an ambitious amount of rate of growth. We're continuing to be mindful about wanting to make sure that this is a program that's serving all corners of Minnesota. We currently have participating high schools in 37 counties, and we would like to see that number obviously expand as we add more high schools to the mix next year. A lot of the work is on continuing to build our partnerships, continuing to improve our communications and our outreach. We know that direct admissions is one piece of the admissions puzzle. We also know that it's a great opportunity to make sure that students are getting information about financial aid, that they're getting information about the benefits of looking for at colleges and universities in the state of Minnesota, and that we're encouraging them to really make a thoughtful choice to find the institution that's the best fit for them. We continue to also collaborate with the Department of Education to incorporate this in with existing programs like the College Knowledge Months and Minnesota Goes to College, and have had a lot of success in terms of those partnerships. Just to give a couple of quick data points, this program has been something that's required significant investment of time and resources. And the good news is that we have the early data that shows that it's doing exactly what we thought it was going to do. So our first set of data from our pilot year, which was the 2022-2023 school year, has come in. And we've seen that students who participated in direct admissions had an over 20% higher rate of completing their FAFSA. So students who participated in direct admissions, 77% of them completed the FAFSA compared to 51% of their peers. And that held. While there were some differences on demographic categories, we saw improvements in FAFSA completion rates across all of our demographic categories. We also know that students who participated in direct admissions were more likely to go to college and were slightly more likely to stay in Minnesota for college, which is exactly what we are hoping the program would result in. Looking at this year, we have about over 22,000 students who will receive a direct admissions letter, which represents about 30% of the seniors in the state of Minnesota. And of those 22,000 students, that's resulted in over 33,000 admissions inquiries to our colleges and universities. And you can see the chart of where those inquiries have been going so far. And we anticipate that that number will only increase as we continue to move through the academic year and students finalize their college choices for next year. You know, one of the things, in addition to the data is always really affirming to see, but it's the student testimonials that have been really, really moving. I think we've all encountered, those of us who work on direct admissions have encountered students who have cried when they've received their letter, families who've been like putting their letter on the refrigerator because it represents a really big step for them and their family. And knowing that students, for some students who, you know, maybe hadn't thought of themselves, hadn't thought that college was accessible to them, that they're really getting a strong positive message from the state that, yep, we've got spaces for you, we've got opportunities and options for you. And so we're really excited to hear those both individual stories and then see those stories reflected in our larger data as well. I think we'll go through there. We did share some student video testimonials, so you can access that at another time. In terms of direct admissions, we will continue. We've opened up for students, high schools, to opt in through March 15th, and so we're really working hard to try to get, again, increase the representation around the state, and so look forward to serving an even larger population of students next year. I'll shift now to talking about a few of the other programs and initiatives that were funded last year that also help us do the work that we do within the Office of Higher Education. One of those is our SLEDS and ECLDS system. Our ability to know what's working and know what the outcomes are for Minnesotans comes from having really robust data systems. One of the exciting updates for SLEDS and ECLDS this year was that we were awarded a $4 million grant for the Federal Institute for Education Science to continue to expand our data collection and reporting over the next 4 years. Anytime we're able to access new and better data, that just helps us continue to serve the state more effectively, and so we're really excited to see the new outcomes that we'll be able to identify through that additional funding. In the legislative session last year, we had a number of projects and special focus areas that the Office of Higher Education was asked to do some work in. And so this is kind of a foreshadowing, spoiler alert, of some exciting reports that you'll get in the future that we're currently working on right now. One of those areas of research was looking at our course placement process. I'm wanting to ensure that when students do course placement as they are enrolling in the Minnesota state system, that the ways that they're placed into courses like math and English are equitable, that they're not serving as a barrier for students, that they don't result in negative outcomes for students. And so we are currently in the midst of doing that research now to better understand the current state of assessment in the Minnesota state system. This study will focus largely on different student communities, including but not limited to Indigenous students, English as a second language learners, and students of color. That project began really last month and will continue until June 2025. We also have a large cross-sector working group exploring best practices around how to best meet student basic needs. We know that giving students access to higher education isn't enough. We also need to make sure that they have support so that they're able to complete their education and to earn the credential that will help give them more, improved economic sustainability in their future. This working group has representatives from students, has representatives from other state agencies, from all sectors of higher education, looking at what are the opportunities that the state can support and colleges and universities can do more beyond having a food pantry, beyond the emergency grant process, knowing that basic needs are complex and can be a really large barrier to student completion. The report from that working group will come out in September 2024. We've also were tested looking at a public service feasibility report to determine whether the viability of a civic engagement program for college students, something that would look at ways that high-impact practices like community-based learning and internships could potentially play a role in student retention and student completion. That project is also currently underway with a report forthcoming. And I will pause for questions as Megan Fitzgibbon comes up to take over the next piece.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. Megan Fitzgibbon with the Office of Higher Education, Manager of Grants and Workforce Initiatives.
Proceed.
I'm here to talk about the several of the programs that were invested in the last session. The first of which is the Emergency Assistance for Postsecondary Students Grant. This was an existing grant that the office was administering, but in the last legislative session, a significant increase in the appropriation was made. Most importantly, there are direct legislatively named grants to the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State Systems to support the emergency assistance grants that are operated on their campuses. We also have an additional $1 million for a competitive grant for private institutions and tribal colleges. All of these funds have been, grants have been issued to the institutions. They are currently providing student support. And these emergency grants at the campus level help to support kind of emergent needs that would otherwise, students could potentially drop or withdraw. So these are things like emergency transportation needs, housing needs, utilities, and sometimes food and other basic needs. Along with that, there's also an increased investment in the Hunger Free Campus grants and an increase in the annual awards to institutions. These are grants that support the Hunger Free Campus designation process or system that is for the institutions. We have two sets of grants. One is for institutions that don't have the designation yet and are seeking a pathway to support that. The grants are up to $225,000 for those. And then an additional $15,000 for institutions that already have the designation that are seeking funds to help sustain it. In this last legislative session, there was an increase of one-time increase of $500,000, specifically for institutions to purchase equipment needed to have an on-campus food bank. This RFP will be out. This grant RFP will be out hopefully in March, if not in early April. This is also a program that was supported and is currently supported with the Student Advisory Council. They approve or review our RFP and help us determine the categories for review before it's awarded as well. Another new program that is a really significant investment for students and particular student parents is the Student Parent Support Initiative. This will be an ongoing program of a little over $5.3 million for the biennium to help institutions provide support for student parents on their campus, whether it's academic support, on-campus childcare, basic needs supports, and other types of student-parent expenses. This is also done with an interagency support with the Minnesota Department of Health. We have one staff person that is at the Department of Health, as well as another at the Office of Higher Ed that helps support kind of the initiatives during the outreach, and will also help with the grant process. This RFP will be available in April or early May. Some of you have been around for a while, but we have an existing program called the Intervention for College Attendance program, ICAP. This program has been around for many years. In October 2023, we awarded $2.7 million to 26 grantees. This program fosters post-secondary attendance and retention. It supports programs that serve historically underserved students in grades 6 through 12, as well as in their first couple of years of college. The maximum award is $120,000 for the biennium. And in this last legislative session, there was a one-time expansion of $300,000. For grants to institutions to support, or not necessarily institutions, it could include other types of organizations, to kind of use the ICAP model to support students who are formerly incarcerated. This RFP is open right now and closes next week on the 23rd. We're excited to see some applications and be able to fund this new process and really pilot some really engaging and supportive programs across the state at different institutions. I'm going to cover a number of healthcare workforce initiatives that were funded last year. The NextGen CNA initiative was a program that was similar out of some work that was funded out of the ARP funds. And as directed by law, this the funding that was in our appropriations bill was transferred to the Minnesota State in last fall to help support this and coordinate and implement this program, the Next Gen Nursing Assistant Training Program at the Health Force Minnesota. We heard a little bit earlier about the paramedic scholarship. This is a new program. The application is now available. It will award 600 paramedics in training with scholarships of $500,000 each, and it will start this fall. In addition to the scholarship, our agency also worked to develop a toolkit for stakeholders, including, as you heard earlier, social media ad buys and other types of content that the institutions that have paramedic programs can use. We also, this is supported or have now a continued program for fellows in addiction medicine. This was a program that was previously funded similarly, but restarted in this last legislative session. It's $540,000 per biennium, and it supports six physicians at area hospital systems. Right now, there are four fellows currently in the program and will be two additional in the next fiscal year. There was also additional support for the Minitex Online Library. This is a statewide system that supports library systems and libraries, public libraries, as well as academic libraries. In the last legislative session, additional funds were made available for Minitex to provide support, both IT and subscription support for the tools and online resources for nursing programs. Post-secondary institutions that have nursing programs and other supporting healthcare-related programs to have access to the electronic research databases and the data needed to complete those programs. We've heard that some of the post-secondary institutions, especially those that are small and have small programs, where they maybe having to find other cuts, this additional support, not having to pay for access to these online resources, is helping them utilize their funds to support other things within the library. You heard Commissioner Olson mention the dual training grants. This is an existing program in our agency, but in this last legislative session, again, there was a nearly $6.4 million one-time increase, as well as an ongoing $2 million increase for the biennium. We also, in a separate bill, received additionally $2 million for the Biennium for, in an ongoing appropriation, for a separate competition that's similar but is specifically for legal cannabis industry employers. So new out of this additional funding and in the legislation that changed it, there are now eligible industries are expanded from the four that existed, advanced manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare services, and IT, now includes childcare, transportation, and the legal cannabis industry. Eligible expenditures are also expended to include recommended books and supplies, and grantees can apply for an additional up to $15,000 or 10% of the grant funding for trainee support costs. These trainee support costs could be anything from tutoring, translation services, mileage, reimbursement, travel reimbursement. We have several programs currently where trainees have to travel, you know, an hour or two to get to their related instruction. Sometimes they go for a week. Sometimes they have to go every week for a whole semester. And additionally, the dual trainee maximum was previously an annual maximum, which meant that sometimes people weren't fully utilizing their availability, and so that was changed to $24,000. The RFP for the existing dual training grant will open mid-March, and we're hoping to have the dual training grant for legal cannabis industry employers open sometime in the spring, might be in March, but probably April or May. There was an increased investment in existing programs, the Minnesota Student Teacher Grants. These are, it's actually two programs, but the Office of Higher Ed markets it and works with students and campuses in it as one program. This is the Student Teachers in Shortage Areas Grant, as well as the Underrepresented Student Teacher Grant. These, both of these programs provide funds to students who are doing, in one term, that they are completing a 12-week or longer student-teacher experience. That could be fall or spring. Sometimes we even have summer. The awards are up to $7,500. It's intended to support those students who generally have to either quit or significantly reduce their hours when they're doing student teaching, because, and then they aren't paid to be student teachers generally. So it's really intended to help support those students. We have the ability to move money between the programs, which has been useful this last year, where we've had a waiting list in the Student Teachers in Shortage Areas grant and not all the funds utilized in the other program. So there's some numbers here in this last, the last year that we have data for. All the funds were utilized for the Student Teachers in Shortage Areas grant, as well as $200,000 that we transferred in from the Underrepresented Student Teacher grant. But, you know, combined, it's, you know, nearly 230 students. This next year, with more money, it will definitely be more students. I think the last time I looked at it was nearly 400 students total across the both programs. Another exciting and new initiative that our agency has been working with the advocates and the supporters of this program for several years now in collaboration for implementing another financial aid program, the ID grant, the grants for students with intellectual and developmental disabilities. In this last legislative session, we have a increase or an investment in the inclusive higher education grants, as well as the Technical Assistance Center. So the Office of Higher Education has entered into a grant, legislatively named grant agreement with the Institute on Community Integration at the University of Minnesota. This is a $250,000 funding for a technical assistance center. They've hired an executive director, Mary Hoff, and she is embarking on a number of initiatives. The good part is that she's been working very closely with this this initiative for many years, and so we have a really good partner at ICI to support this. We will have a competitive grant of $750,000 a year. We're expecting to have that open in May. This will be for post-secondary institutions to either develop or enhance their existing initiatives for students with an intellectual or developmental disability. There's links in here for all the great work that's happening over at ICI and the Technical Assistance Center. Dennis mentioned earlier, another significant investment as well as statutorily required benefit for American Indian students starting this year is the American Indian Scholars. This is a benefit for eligible American Indian students where there is a first dollar tuition and fee pathway. It's a first dollar tuition and fee waiver at the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. Eligible students include those that are Minnesota residents based on resident tuition, who are enrolled members or citizens of any federally recognized tribe or Canadian First Nation. It also includes students who are not eligible for resident tuition, but who are enrolled members or citizens of a tribal nation located in Minnesota. We've heard from many students who are benefiting from this. Campuses, both the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State, have developed applications. They are applying and they're receiving it. And as the longtime administrator of the Minnesota Indian Scholarship Program, I can tell you just seeing the change on what we're coming in from that program and the number of students that are benefiting from it is really remarkable. It is administered at the system or at the campus level, so students who are interested in this will want to reach out to their campus specifically. There was funds appropriated to implement this program, American Indian Scholars. Those institutions that utilize funds for that will report to OHE. That report is due later this year after, obviously, they've used the funds. There was an additional investment in the Tribal College Supplemental Assistance Grants as well, and this includes $1 million for the biennium to each of the tribal colleges in Minnesota, Red Lake Nation College, Red Lake Nation College, White Earth, and Leech Lake. And this is $1 million specifically for operations and maintenance. We've had some contact with all the tribal colleges. We'll be working on hopefully developing and getting those contracts set up in the next few weeks to get those funds out to the campuses. Finally, I'm going to, before I hand it off to my other colleague, talk about briefly about the legislatively named grant to Foster Advocates, which is a nonprofit organization that supports individuals in foster care and or transitioning out. There's a $500,000 per year grant to the Foster Advocates organization. They will it will help for them to expand and enhance their wraparound services to students. And this is in support of the financial aid program, the Fostering Independence Grant, FIG, that helps to provide financial aid and assistance to those students. We have a meeting next week. We'll have this contract in place probably within the next 3 or 4 weeks. I can stand for questions, but I'm also going to hand it off to my financial aid
representative
as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I've got questions for both, actually, because I had a question before, but so you said that the American Indian scholarships were first dollar against tuition and fees, and so many of the things that we've done as of recent have been last dollar, and I'm just wondering if you can let me know kind of the history of that. Is that how it's always been? It's always been first money, so before they get any federal Pell or anything like that, this money covers tuition and fees? I'm not quite understanding why it's first dollar.
Manager Fitzgibbon.
Yeah. Chair, Representative Rarick, it is first dollar, and it's a historically new program that is providing. It was modeled after the existing waiver that's at the University of Minnesota Morris for American Indian students. So, yes, it comes before any other aid, and that is historic, and it is ensures that the funds are from the other programs are, you know, additionally helping those students and makes it so that they have their entire cost of education covered or a good chunk of it if they receive aid through the other programs. But it is first dollar, so the waiver comes and then any other aid those students that are eligible to receive is on top of that waiver.
Representative Rare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then it covers like room and board and extraneous things. Okay.
Chair, Representative, the waiver covers tuition and fees, but if they have other aid, that would go towards, yes, their room and board, their transportation, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you. I understand. Thank you. So back to the healthcare workers initiatives, specifically the paramedic scholarships. As I've been out in my community and talking to EMTs and paramedics, there's a $122 million shortfall statewide, and we'll hear about this in other committees, but because of reimbursements are so low, and they're saying those that are actually in the field right now are saying that that's a real big hardship for ambulance services and such. Are you hearing anything? I'm not sure what the uptake is for the paramedic scholarships, but if they're out there talking to people about how difficult it is to be a paramedic and the reimbursement is so low, the pay is so low, on and on and on, are you having difficulty with uptake of the scholarship because of the extraneous factors that are happening? Nonetheless, it's $122 million shortfall statewide.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson, or who wishes to respond?
Chair, Representative Berg, the application just opened. I don't know how many applications we've received so far. I know we definitely have heard from those that are interested. They're seeing our outreach and have been, you know, anxiously awaiting the application. I don't know how many applications we've received so far.
Representative Rarick, I'll help you a little bit with that one. As a result of the hearing that we had in Winona from the EMS Task Force, this has been a very popular program, and we heard repetitively that day that they were amazed that it was already out and that it was receptive. I don't think you have numbers yet, but from what we heard in Winona with the 70 to 80 people who were there, this is something that's going to be used and used well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope so, because there's a tremendous need. It's very, very difficult to get EMTs and paramedics to work within the system that is there currently and very expensive. So I appreciate you saying that.
Representative Rick, I'll repeat what I said earlier. The praise of the office for getting it out there and getting the information out was heard that day repetitively. So I can't say enough for the Office of Higher Ed and how they're unrolling these programs so people can have access to them.
Thank you. I have a couple more quick
questions.
Okay,
Representative Brewer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, also that information. That's obviously, we all want the ambulance to show up when we need them, and they're teetering on the brink right now, as I'm hearing from the associations. When I saw that, I'm like, oh, this is a real problem and a real big problem. On the emergency assistance of post-secondary students grants, and I realize that, it's just kind of gone out, but is there a cap, like the maximum that a student could obtain for these emergency grants? And what do you expect an average grant probably would be? And maybe that's an unfair question, but the first one I would like to know.
Manager Fitzgibbon or... Okay, Manager.
Chair, Representative Merrick. Yes, the programs have just gone out. The campuses and the systems themselves for Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota, they actually set their own maximums. It's a grant. I believe in our previous reports on the program that existed prior that wasn't funded as much, but there was usually it was around, you know, a max of like $1,000. I know the University of Minnesota sets kind of like a once in their career maximum, so they can only get it one time when they're enrolled in a particular program. Minnesota State has a little bit different of a maximum. Maybe it's once per academic year, once per award year. They usually tend to be under $1,000.
Mm-hmm. Representative Brewer.
One final question if I get back to it. Oh. So on the direct admissions, which you finally sold me on it, I have to say. I can be convinced. You had, in your slide, you had tiers 1 through 6, but you didn't mention what the tiers mean. I'm just curious what that means, and I don't want to assume.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Barrick. When the colleges and universities choose to participate in the program, so we have 55 colleges and universities that have opted in, they get to choose an academic tier at which they're comfortable making that offer, that guarantee of admission to students. And so the tiers are based on the student's academic performance through the end of their junior year, looking at their unweighted GPA, and then looking at their grades in their core subjects of English, math, and science. And so they start with tier one is all students who are on track to graduate from high school, down to up to tier 6, which is students who are at a 3.5 GPA or higher. And so the colleges and universities get to choose kind of the level that feels like it's in alignment with their enrollment goals and their admission standards.
Representative Eric.
Thank you. That brings up the other question I actually did have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, partially because of the pandemic, but some of it is just historical. For example, like the Minneapolis School District, before the pandemic, had just achieved a 50% graduation rate. And it's been widely reported also that we're way below proficiencies through the whole system, educational system of math, science, and reading. I mean, just it's scary. I have a very close relative that works in the tutoring industry, and he just blatantly says kids can't read, write, or do math, and it's terrifying. So I'm just wondering, are you, with the direct admissions, are you seeing challenges? I'll just say that. Are you seeing challenges from specific school districts that have a really low graduation rate? I know that Minneapolis probably is below 50% now. I know out in my area, even when we typically have, in Rutt County, we typically have a 95 to 97% graduation rate. They've also seen a decline since the pandemic. Are you seeing that impact on the direct admissions program? I know it's new, but maybe in the uptake, you're seeing some challenges in some school districts.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski and Representative Eric. Just to clarify, do you mean challenges related to how they're performing when they get to college or their level of engagement with the direct admissions program?
Representative Eric.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the ability for that school district to kind of partner with OHE to do the direct admissions because they have literally just so much going on. They have attainment competency issues. They have graduation issues. And maybe this is just a step too far for them. I'm just wondering if that's been an impediment to actually implement the direct admissions program.
Assistant Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski and Representative Eric. So this is the second year of the program. In both the pilot year and this year, we've had a handful of schools that have signed up to do the program and have not been able to actually get across the finish line to get their letters to the students. The challenges that they faced have not been really related to the students' academic performance or that they've reported based on their graduation rates. The challenges for the students, the schools that haven't been able to complete all of the steps of the program have generally been around staffing turnover and sometimes around the ability of their like student information system and getting the sort of technology piece of it up. The academic concern hasn't really emerged as a perceived barrier to the program.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair. Thank you, I'm good, thank you.
All right, proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for being here, and thank you for talking about the cannabis dual training grants. As you launch those, I do want to raise just some things that I've heard out in the community about what has been occurring when people are inquiring about these. I know it is a dual program between agencies as well, but our current hemp manufacturers are arguably some of the workforce who will be going into our cannabis industry. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, there will not be a cannabis industry when you are proposing that these things would be ready. But I would really ask that we make sure that when we're talking to the businesses who are trying to access these, that we're aware of the pipeline of workers and that this current hemp industry is going to be providing a significant amount of the manufacturing help that we will have in the cannabis industry. And so some businesses, hemp manufacturers, have already applied for some of these grants that were available through that are already available, not necessarily through you, but just really tying together everything that is going to be what our cannabis industry will look like in the end it's important to empower those folks who are coming up right now. So if you have any questions about that, I'm happy to answer about it. It's probably out of the scope for this entire committee, but I did want to put that on record. I've been contacted by a lot of people who want to participate in this and they want to add to this workforce, but they're being told you're not in cannabis now, so therefore you can't participate in this. And I think we're just putting ourselves at a disservice there. So thank you.
Chair, if I may.
Yep. Please do.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. We definitely have been working with that with the Department of Labor and Industry. One thing that is just important that I really want to make sure people know is that There is a special pot of money for legal cannabis industry employers, but any employer can apply for funds under the existing dual training grant, which is has an historic one-time increase in it. And all of the occupations that are under the seven industries would be available to any employer, including agriculture. And there are a number of occupations that are essentially the same occupation, whether it's in illegal cannabis or under agriculture. So any of those employers would also be able to apply for that, even if they aren't deemed legal cannabis industry yet.
Representative Hanson. Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you for that answer. I agree with you, and I'm on the same page. Just in practice, that's not what's happening, and so I just want to make sure that we're aware of it, raising it. I have people who have asked me to make sure I bring it up every time that program comes up, so I did that. Thank you.
So, Representative Hanson, are we getting a new definition to the Higher Education Committee?
Hey, you're the chair. You decide.
That's all right, Representative Hanson. All right, proceed.
I'm going to hand it off to my colleague, the other Megan in the office.
Okay.
1 second.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. My name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the Manager of State Financial Aid Programs. Can I introduce yourself?
And good morning. My name is Nicole Whalen, and I am the State Grant Research Manager.
All right. And is it financial aid first?
Yes. Yeah, okay. We'll talk about a number of the financial aid programs. So
right. As
we've shared with this committee before, we've had tremendous success with the Fostering Independence Higher Education Grants program. In our first year, we far exceeded expectations with the program in terms of take up from students. The partnership we had with a data sharing agreement with the Department of Human Services to be able to eliminate any kind of application beyond the traditional FAFSA application. And we've seen in year two of that program that it has continued to increase. We've expanded significantly, both in terms of the number of students served by the program, as well as the different institutions where these students are enrolling. We've also had a couple of new schools join into the program, which has been very exciting. One reminder about this financial aid program is that it is looking at cost of attendance, and that cost of attendance is set by each school. So each school does set that, and they look at market trends, surveys, rent, food costs, things of that nature. And definitely we probably have seen some impact on those cost of attendance rates based on inflation. We also do anecdotally hear some that students, before knowing about the program, may have increased their credit load because they can get a little bit more funded that way. A little bit of data here for you regarding the increases we've seen. We've seen increases in all five sectors for the program. So that is also showing some uptake in areas that we didn't see that first year of the program, but really have taken off in the second year of the program. We do see that the greater increase has happened across the four-year institutions, and those four-year institutions do tend to have a little bit higher awards. But you can see in some sectors we've had double-digit increases and significant increases in others. The FAFSA simplification, I know many of you have been hearing about that from your constituents. It's been a very intense and exhausting year on all things federal aid related. We continue to be in constant communication with our partners at Federal Student Aid, as well as our Minnesota colleges and universities to help mitigate the impacts of this challenging FAFSA cycle. As you recall from the last session, we made several investments in the state grant program, as well as technical changes to the federal pieces. The federal pieces, if you remember, were really related to simplifying the FAFSA process, as well as simplifying the process related to how income information comes into the FAFSA. So some key pieces related to removing the drug offense conviction not being a barrier to receiving federal Title IV aid. Selective service registration was eliminated at the federal level. Some technical naming changes from the expected family contribution to the SAI, and now allowing that federal needs analysis measurement to go to a negative number, which is the first time we've ever experienced that. We also had the repeal on the ban on Pell Grants for incarcerated individuals, and then restoring Pell Grant for some students who had been enrolled at fraudulent schools. The no longer considering the number of household members in the college when calculating federal needs and analysis is related to where the data now comes from, since the vast majority of data is not hand-entered. It's all coming directly through the Future Act fully being implemented with the IRS direct data sharing agreement with federal student aid. And then a change to looking at divorced parents from not reporting the income and assets of the parent who the student lived with the most, but really the parent who provided the majority of the actual financial support. As you may recall, Minnesota and our state, we do use the FAFSA as a way to apply for a primary need-based program, the Minnesota DREAM Act. We did make some changes last session in order to confine or with federal law and FAFSA be a little bit more similar to the federal Pell Grant. One of the investments we did make was to increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance, which is universal for all colleges and universities in Minnesota that participate in the state grant program. We do anticipate the impact of that will be a full-time student will see an average grant increase of about $330. We also changed the Minnesota state grant to align with the federal Pell Grant, being the last day of the fiscal year, and then several other technical changes to our wording in our state statute so they would align with the federal changes. Giving you a little bit of information about that new investment in that increase from 109% to 115% for the LME, the Living and Miscellaneous Expense Allowance, you can see here that we're seeing the total increase in state grant awards at 63% for four-year institutions and 37% for two-year. When you look a little bit closer on that two-year type, it's predominantly at those public two-year institutions. And then when you look at the four-year more specifically, you're looking at a fairly even split between those three main sectors, with obviously a smaller split where there's not as many institutions in that private for-profit sector. Commissioner Olson mentioned that yesterday we had a public projections meeting, which we do twice a year. We do have some changes in our state grant projections, primarily due to the enrollment increases that we mentioned early on in our conversation today. We also did receive just 2 weeks ago a third version of final parameters from federal student aid for the needs analysis formula for next year. Those changes were good changes because they did take into account inflation, which was high over the last couple of years, and will expand access to federal Pell Grants as well as Minnesota state grants to more students. So those changes are meaning that we are projecting that we will come in above available resources at about 4%. We'll continue to monitor enrollment as those enrollment projections, especially for fiscal year 25, and we actually start to receive those federal needs analysis records next month. Moving on to the North Star Promise program, we've talked quite a bit about this program throughout the presentation as well. Hopefully this committee is fairly aware of it. We've been doing our very best to promote the program, to make sure that we're getting visibility and interacting with other state agencies as well as our community and campus partners. With success in a lot of areas, especially we're starting to see the potential for stabilizing enrollment. And as we mentioned, that first time increase in a 14-year decline in matriculation at Minnesota colleges and universities, and really hoping to use this program as a driver to help fill some of those state labor force vacancies, and estimating that we'll have 15,000 to 20,000 students. Again, this isn't a program that's going to require a separate application, and we will work with campuses to make sure those awards happen. Just a quick reminder, we had some materials handout, so I won't spend too much time on this given where we're at with the clock, about the eligibility for the program. Those are in your handouts as well, and probably a little bit more expanded upon there. This is a last dollar program, so the way that the program is written, it will first take into account or calculate the student's individual per semester tuition and fees, and then subtract out any other federal, institutional, or state gift aid, and then it will cover the remaining balance for the student for their tuition and mandatory fees. It does not cover books, fees, or transportation. This part, just given where we're at in time, I won't spend too much time on, but we do have not a limit on the dollar amount per se, so it's not a flat award. And a student can see, as you see, it's a customized award since it's built for each student. But it really is something where the student can continue to receive that last dollar resource throughout their 2 or 4 year degree. There are some limits on the equivalent of how long they can attend. So if a student is pursuing a certificate or an associate's degree, they can receive the equivalent of 4 full-time semesters of the award. And then for students who are pursuing 4 year degree programs, it's a little bit longer, 8 full-time semesters or the equivalent. We also have a secondary component to the program, which we're calling the North Star Promise Plus, which is an add-on for those students who happen to be North Star Promise eligible and are also income eligible for the federal Pell Grant. We're still determining, based on some analysis of that impact of the needs analysis and program uptake, on what that match will be. And then finally, just looking at what we're projecting when we did a reassessment earlier this month. We do now provide publicly twice a year North Star Promise projections, just like we do with the Minnesota State Grant. And so for that program, because of those increased investments in the Minnesota State Grant, as well as that change more specifically to the needs analysis, creating more eligibility for Pell and State, we're seeing the estimate on the North Star Promise come down a little bit. And you can kind of read across the chart here, seeing where we're projecting those student counts, as well as what we are estimating at this point that average award would be, and then the total amount that we would anticipate in expenditures to each of the sectors listed. With that, I know we put a lot on you and gave you a lot to think about, but we're happy to answer questions.
Questions, members? Representative Colter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure other folks will have questions about more sort of specific sections of this, so I'm going to try and be quick here. And this, I think, may be a question for Commissioner Olson. I'm not sure. But I took me a moment to find it, but one of my favorite sections of statute, and the fact that I have a favorite section of statute probably says something about me, but one of my favorite sections of statute is 135A.01, because it says that it shall be the policy of the state legislature to fund approximately 2/3 of the total amount of general fund spending, tuition, and fees at the University of Minnesota. Of course, there's nothing holding us to that, and we haven't been anywhere near that for, I would wager, probably 20 years or so. But it's interesting to me that it's in there, and it's like something for us to feel good about having in statute, I suppose. But my question is, you know, understanding, of course, that we are not going to reverse 2 decades of, to use a somewhat loaded term, defunding higher education in the state of Minnesota in 2 years. My question is if you can give us a sense of sort of where that number is after the last budget that we passed, and in essence sort of what progress have we made at trying to close that gap?
Commissioner, or do you need someone
else?
That's
a big question, I know.
Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Colter. Yeah, looking at the clock here, this may be one where I would probably wait to answer until we probably come back on Tuesday. But, you know, I will say those lines have been crossing over each other around kind of the 50-50 mark, depending on the particular biennial session. You know, it'll be 48-52, 51-49 given, but we haven't been anywhere near that 2/3 legislative goal for, like you had mentioned, decades. But we can bring you the specific data.
Representative Colter, there have been numerous attempts to repeal that statute. It's also one of my favorite statutes. So when we have repealers, read them very closely. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad to hear that the commissioner is going to come back Tuesday, because I think there are several questions with all these new programs that are coming up. I had just, this is an anecdote, but I want to hear from you on this. A friend of ours owns a couple of pizza restaurants. And when the new college, or the free college for those making $80,000 or less was passed, the manager of one of the stores that was making $90,000 a year decided to quit his job so that he could get free college tuition for his kids. And I'm wondering if you're hearing similar anecdotes, and if so, or if whether you're not, you have that. I know this is probably happening, especially for people that are on that bubble for income. What can we do to remedy that so that we're not losing people out of the workforce so that they can just take advantage of a government program?
Commissioner Olson, I might just paraphrase what was just asked. Do you have any data that would substantiate Representative Scott's question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I do not. You know, and I will just kind of offer that this program hasn't started yet. So there's a lot of conversations out there about, you know, eligibility. You know, I know we are looking a couple of years back at income data. So that very well may be the case, but no specific data to substantiate any of that yet. And, you know, maybe potentially we will see. And, you know, hopefully it'll tell us a story that we're on a good track and could potentially invest even more to, you know, inch the income threshold up a little bit, but it has yet to be seen. This program has not even started yet.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair. And I guess I'm interested, too, if it becomes prevalent that that is an issue, your solution of just moving up the income guidelines to me is, well, it's just going to scoop more people into the program. My other question has to do with your projections going forward. On the 9th of January or February, there was an article in the Star Tribune talking about K-12 schools and the influx of new English-speaking students. And it's become quite an issue. And so my question for you is, A, what is the requirement for residency? I understand it's just 1 year in Minnesota to qualify for this. And do you anticipate that more and more people will take advantage of the quote-unquote free college because of the fact, well, the data is showing that more people are, more students are enrolling in K-12 schools, so that's going to up that a little bit. So have you taken that into consideration?
Commissioner Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, appreciate the questions there. You know, I think I would offer a handful of different answers. One, and Megan would be able to speak best to this, but, you know, there are more than one way to establish residency within the state. Matter of fact, there's around 10 different options to establish residency for qualification and participation in our state financial aid programs. I would just say again, this isn't the be-all end-all. This is one of a multitude of a very, you know, aggressive and exciting financial aid, state financial aid opportunities for students. You know, married directly with the Minnesota State Grant Program, we know how successful that has been, as well as all the other financial aid programs that we've shared here today. This is simply one, and so it's another tool in the toolbox. We do hope folks participate and, you know, ultimately meet the goals that we outlined for the program, which we've heard from the committee time and time again, was to help support our institutions and support students, you know, whether it be through enrollment initiatives or other. This is simply one more option and opportunity.
Representative Scott, members, we're going to stop at our regular time of noon. I'm not going to impose delays in other committees because of what's happened with the session and the Rules Committee. So, Representative Scott, you want to continue?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So that same article that I referenced said that Minnesota is becoming one of the top 10 magnet states to come to. And so I'm just curious, or maybe this is just a comment, to probably take that into consideration for your programs. Because we're, you know, I remember hating the FAFSA, filling that out. Everybody, I don't know a parent that enjoyed it, but my kids got zero help for college and still paying off school loans, okay? And so it seems wildly to me unfair that someone that would come here from another country, come here illegally, and get in front of kids that have been here a long time. Their parents are paying taxes. They're contributing to this, to Minnesota's economy. And then somebody comes in because of a program like this, and we're a magnet to bring more of those people here, and I get to sit back and pay for that. And I think there are a lot of people that are not happy about about that. But all that to say, I think you need to look at projections, because I think it's going to do nothing but go up.
Members, we're rapidly coming on the closing time. I have McDonald, Hicks, Knorr, and Cleavorn, and I would hope that they would hold their questions until Tuesday. I want to remind the members that at the beginning of the hearing, the commissioner told us that there are three private colleges and North Dakota State that is also initiating this program. So there may be other reasons than we have heard in recent questioning. And with that, meeting is adjourned.